Thanks, thank you for a very kind and undeserved introduction. So last time I started talking about critical surface surface states in 2+1 dimensions, and I gave a few potential examples of such states in condensed matter systems. And essentially all of those states involve a Gabler boson interacting with the surface surface, and that Gabler boson could be the order parameter at some metallic transition in the metal, or it could be an emerging gauge field systems such as the U1 spin liquid with a spin on firm surface, or the hot field one bell level. And we saw that these systems are, in terms of theory, very similar. And I argued that perhaps the right way to think about the structure of non-parabolic singularities in these states is in terms of this two-patch theory that I'll remind you about in a minute. And I talked a little bit about scaling in that two-patch theory. And then we'll talk more about scaling today. I will try to convince you that you can write down scaling forms for correlation functions. Just for symmetry properties, you can do quite a bit. Then to actually go beyond scaling forms and calculate, say, along one dimension systematically, we would like to do some kind of an expansion. And what I will tell you about today is another sad story discovered by some C2E, who is not here, I think.
Some 60 bars, it's a pity you were so high on it.
Thanks. No problem. So I'll try to convince you that actually in this theory, as given, we cannot do a large N expansion, and I will talk a little bit about some ideas of Sunk 6 about perhaps doing a kind of genus expansion on this theory, similar to what people, at least formally similar to what you're all very much familiar with in Yang-Mills theory. But I will show that even that probably fails. And after that, I will turn to a happier part of my story. I will introduce a model originally discussed by Chetan Nayak and Frank Wilczek, where we hope that one can actually do some systematic calculations. And this model, in many ways, is quite similar to the problem that that I discussed originally. And after that, I will turn to a slightly different subject, that of pairing instability in critical Fermi surface states. And this is rather recent work that I'm quite excited about. And here we'll see that we'll have to go beyond the two-patch theory to really describe this physics. And there will be new, both conceptual and technical complications. Let's go back to our two-patch theory. Remember, I introduced this last time. So there are these fermions living at two patches on the Fermi surface, interacting with some boson gauge field in this case. And I've discussed that there is a very definite scaling of momenta that we have to do in this theory. And I discussed that this scaling of momenta is actually not renormalized in perturbation theory. And also, I motivated the following scaling of time with the anomalous dimension z equal to 3. And I will use this scaling as a starting point. But in principle, later we'll see that the dynamical exponent z can renormalize. So that's where we left off last time. And we also saw that actually this theory doesn't have a doesn't have any dimensionless expansion parameter. I've scaled everything out here except this constant e squared, which is actually dimensionful. And you know, in essence of an expansion parameter, we invent one, and the usual approach is the large n expansion, where the fermions are promoted to have n flavors, and then one just does saddle point approximation. So we'll see in a few slides that this actually fails for the present problem. But for now, let me go along this route just to set it up a little bit, and also as a kind of a sanity check on the scaling, on the type of scalings that that I've discussed. So what do we do in the large n expansion? Well, first thing we do, we compute this RPA bubble, and we include it in the boson propagator. And you see that this bubble computed in the two-patch theory gives you exactly the same result, the same Landau damping that you would get if you had computed it in the theory with a full Fermi surface. So that's encouraging, and of course you get this this form respecting the scaling with z equal to 3. And if you want to calculate the fermion self-energy at leading order in 1 over n, you do this one loop diagram. Again, the one loop diagram in the two patch theory turns out to give you exactly the same frequency behavior as if you did the diagram with a full Fermi surface. So that's again encouraging. You see that if you include the self energy in the fermion propagator, it again respects the scaling with dynamical exponent z equal to 3. Notice this 1 over n in the denominator here. This 1 over n will come to haunt us later. Okay, yeah?
But is it probably the worst problem with the marginal
fermi liquid? Yes. We'll encounter the marginal fermi liquid in a few slides. This is a true non-fermi liquid in the sense that the quasi-particle residue vanishes as a power law rather than logarithmically as you approach the Fermi surface. Okay, but of course I didn't introduce this whole machinery of the two-patch theory to just reproduce RPA. I introduced it so that hopefully we will be able to write down general scaling properties and compute anomalous dimensions. And even without any explicit calculations, one can constrain the RG properties of this model quite a bit. So one uses symmetries. In particular, one symmetry I already discussed, the symmetry that makes this term and this term renormalize in the same way, keeping the Fermi surface curvature fixed. And the other symmetry is just the usual gauge symmetry, which forces the coefficient of gauge fermion coupling to renormalize in the same way as this term. So as a result of those symmetries, all the correlation functions of fermions and gauge fields only involve potentially two anomalous dimensions. One is the fermion anomalous dimension related to the usual fermion field strength renormalization. And the other is the dynamical critical exponent z, which in principle can renormalize and is related to the renormalization of this coupling square. And now with this insight, one can write down the scaling forms for the two-point functions in particular. So let me start with the gauge field propagator. You see that this gauge field propagator involves only one of the critical exponents, namely z. And in fact, simple Landau damping is consistent with this scaling form for any value of z. On the other hand, the static behavior of the propagator is sensitive to z. And in particular, if z is different from 3, then this becomes non-analytic. Now, if we switch to the Fermat propagator, it now involves both of the anomalous dimensions, eta f and z. And it kind of looks like the fermion dynamical exponent is half of the boson dynamical exponent. And that's due to the fact that the fermion propagates perpendicular to the Fermi surface. And as we discussed before, the gauge fluctuations are primarily tangent to the Fermi surface. Now, if you look at the static and dynamic behavior of this Green's function, then generally both are non-Fermi liquid-like, provided that this exponent eta f is non-zero. You might say that in this gauge field problem, perhaps we shouldn't really worry about the fermion-Green's function too much, because it's not a not a physical observable. It's not gauge invariant. However, in the problem of a phase transition in a metal, you can do exactly the same formalism. And there, the fermion-Green's function, you actually can measure. It's a physical quantity. OK. So now, ideally, we would like to calculate these critical exponents and scaling forms systematically. However, it turns out that we cannot do this in the large N expansion. And signs of this appear when you try to go to higher order in perturbation theory. So typically, when we do standard large N expansion, we use just the bare fermion propagator. However, if you do this in the present problem, you run into divergences with this of the type 1 over eta. And remember, eta was this coefficient that we put in front of the irrelevant fermion kinetic term in the Lagrangian to remind ourselves that it's irrelevant. And this eta was supposed to be sent to 0 at the end of the day. So we cannot send eta to 0 here. Now that's really what that's telling you, is that every time, since eta appears in front of an irrelevant perturbation, every time you have an eta, you have a power of frequency, in this case, omega to 1/3. So one of our eta divergences are really infrared divergences. So you have a very strong infrared divergence in this graph, as observed by Sang-Sik. And there are a number of graphs where such such divergences occur also in self-energy graphs. And it's clear where these divergences are coming from. It's due to the fact that you are using the bare fermion propagator, which has the wrong dynamics. It has dynamics with a fermionic z equal to 1, but rather, from what I've just argued, fermionic z is closer to 3/2. So there is a simple fix for this. Let's just dress the fermion propagator by the one-loop self-energy. And that gets rid of the very strong power law infrared divergences in favor of weaker logarithmic divergences that you might hope to sum up with RG at the end of the day. So that's OK. But in the process, you've traded the small parameter eta for a small parameter 1 over n sitting right here. So every time you had a 1 over eta divergence, you now have an enhancement factor of n. And as a result, these diagrams that previously had infrared divergences now become of the same order in n as the leading terms. So large n counting is violated in this way. There is perhaps another way of thinking about this. If I write down this fermion propagator, including both the bare irrelevant tree-level term and this long-loop self-energy, then I see that the non-Fermi liquid self-energy becomes more important than the tree-level term at this crossover scale lambda. And you see that this crossover scale goes to 0 as n goes to infinity. So in a sense, the limits energy to 0 and n to infinity do not commute for this problem. OK, so So we saw that there are some diagrams in which accounting of n is violated, and the question is whether one can systematically classify these diagrams. And the question was answered by Sang-Sik. But first to understand, first we have to understand where do these extra powers of n come from. Well, they obviously come from this 1 over n in the denominator here. But to access this 1 over n, we need the fermion momentum to go to the Fermi surface. So the problem of counting powers of n in a given diagram reduces to the problem of finding the phase space in a diagram where all the fermions are on the Fermi surface. And that problem can be solved. It's an old trick of the so-called double line representation. So we notice that any boson momentum can be written as a difference of two fermion momenta on the Fermi surface, can be written uniquely up to an inversion around the Fermi surface. So now let me thicken these boson propagators into double lines, with the index along each line being a momentum on the Fermi surface. And let me do this to all boson lines in a given diagram. For now, let me only consider bubble graphs, vacuum energy graphs. So then, as a result, I get something that looks like this. Now, what you can do with this is you can make this diagram in the double line representation into a surface. So let's imagine taking these loops obtained by connecting the fermion and the double line boson propagators, and let's attach faces to them. And let's also attach faces to the original fermion loops in a given diagram. And then we glue all these faces together along the propagator. And we get some surface as a result. Now what Sang-Sik has observed is that the genus of the resulting surface is related to the degree of the diagram in N, which is quite amazing. And at N equal infinity, one has to sum all the planar diagrams, just like Young-Mills theory. However, I'll caution you here that the analogy is a little bit formal, because in Young-Mills theory, the index on the double lines, the indices are really the indices of the gauge group, and the factors out front are just essentially in some sense combinatorial, or they can be neatly separated from the dynamics. Here, the indices running along these loops are really momenta on the Fermi surface. And they don't factor out of the integral. You still have to do the integral over all the momenta. So it's a little bit more involved. Okay. So Sang-Sik has actually considered a theory with only a single patch. And that theory turns out to be much simpler than the full two-patch theory. In particular, he has been able to argue that all the planar diagrams don't involve any ultraviolet divergences, such that the dynamical exponent remains unrenormalized, and the fermion anomalous dimension is zero in the limit n equal to infinity. And this is essentially due to special kinematics of a single patch, a kind of chiral kinematics where all the fermions move in one direction. And we wanted to see whether this result survives in any way for the two-patch theory. And here we ran into trouble. So we observed that for the full two-patch theory, divergences start to appear in planar graphs, so that we expect anomalous dimensions. And also we found that even the sophisticated large N genus counting is violated once you have two patches. So, you know, we initially started...
I thought the original large N counting was for two patches.
Well, so Sensik's paper was strictly speaking for a single patch. It's not obvious, you know, you can also do the same counting for two patches, but...
Sorry, the large N is counted, is violated because of the divergences or just violated?
Essentially because of the divergences. You'll see in a minute.
So if you put in a cutoff, it's still valid, but...
No. It's... I'll explain in a second. As I said, you know, this large N counting is not as solid as in Young-Mills theory, because really you're counting some phase space, and it's much, much more subtle. So we wanted to look for. Anomalous dimensions, and in particular for normalizations of the dynamical exponent z. And the place to look is in the boson self-energy. And we went to three-loop order here. And luckily, only two diagrams can have divergences at three-loop order, these so-called Aslamazov-Larkin diagrams. And according to the genus counting, you would expect This diagram is planar, and you would expect to scale as n. This diagram is non-planar, and you expect it to scale as 1. Now, when you do the actual calculation, both of these diagrams scale as n. And what's much worse, they have this power of q to the 3 halves, a very strong infrared divergence. And this infrared divergence doesn't come from the two-patch region. It comes actually from the whole Fermi surface. So really, individually, there is a breakdown of the two-patch. It's a non-local divergence. There is a breakdown of the two-patch theory here. Now, magically, these two diagrams, when you add them, the strong infrared divergence cancels. And this was known already in the work of Andrei Chubukov. And what you're left with after this cancellation is an analytic Q squared piece, which now comes only from the two-patch region. But in the process of this cancellation, you've earned yourself an extra power of n to the 1 half. So this is actually even stronger in n than the bare piece that you started with. But the dynamical exponent magically remains under-normalized from its value of 3.
In the previous graph, you said eta is non-zero now.
Yes, but this is just looking for the renormalization of z.
Sorry, I don't mean to confuse you, but eta is still the coefficient of the kinetic term, like the ordinary kinetic term.
Oh, sorry. So sorry. This eta has a subscript f. This is the fermion anomalous dimension. It's not related to the coefficient of the kinetic term. Right. Okay. Next, we went looking for the fermion anomalous dimension. And the place to look at three-loop order is, again, these two graphs. And here, the situation is much more sane. If you do genus counting, this graph is planar. This graph is non-planar. You expect this one to be of order 1, this one to be suppressed. And it is suppressed. And you know, so that's exactly what you find when you do the calculation. But in addition, you find that both of these graphs have a logarithmic divergence in the momentum-dependent part of the self-energy. That's exactly what you expect. That's exactly where you expect the divergence to appear. And if I very boldly exponentiate this logarithm and interpret the coefficient as the power, then I get the Fermion anomalous dimension. It's not suppressed in the large n limit due to the presence of this planar graph. Nevertheless, this Fermion anomalous dimension is numerically rather small. So there is some hope that this is some kind of a 1 over 4 pi expansion. Now,
so what's this? Is the sign infection probably either more singular or less singular than
the less singular. Right. So these calculations raise a few questions. Perhaps the one that strikes me most is whether perhaps z is equal to 3 to all orders. Perhaps there is some hidden symmetry here protecting z from renormalizing. And perhaps even a more pressing question is whether one runs into these non-local divergences in other graphs, and whether, remember this q to the 3 half type divergences, and whether these divergences always cancel. Is there some magic symmetry that makes them cancel, and perhaps that same magic symmetry is also the one that prohibits weaker logarithmic renormalizations of the boson self-energy. There is also a question of whether there even is a sensible large n limit here after we found this n to the 3 half coefficient of the boson self-energy.
So, I mean, these singular contributions from outside the two-batch region, these non-local effects, they only occur because you're looking at larger n?
No, they occur for any value of n.
So don't they put into question the whole two-patch theory?
Yes, this is probably the elephant in the room. This is the most pressing question. But so, for example, there's...
you gave at the beginning a rather hand-waving but convincing argument for the two-patch theory. Where does it go wrong?
There are... So, I have... So I believe that perhaps this is the only two diagrams where you can get a contribution which is significant from outside the two-patch, from outside the two-patch regime.
Diagram from Schatz.
Yes, but I'm not fully convinced.
So are there many? There are other diagrams that have been looked at which are okay. I already done.
I think Andrei Chubukov has investigated all diagrams to this three-loop order and always found this cancellation. But this cancellation actually is not necessary. For example, if you look not at a pneumatic transition, but at a transition in the spin channel, for example, a ferromagnetic transition, then this cancellation does not occur. So it's not, there is no very fundamental reason for it to occur. I will later, when I discuss pairing, I will show you some other deficiencies of the two-patch theory where similar problems happen. Okay, as I said, you can do the same story for the pneumatic transition. Here, instead of the gauge field, we have the pneumatic order parameter. And the only difference is that pneumatic fluctuations couple to the Fermi surface in the L equal 2 rather than the L equal 1 channel, like the gauge field. So pneumatic fluctuations couple with the same sign to the two patches on the Fermi surface. And as a result, the value of the Fermi anomalous dimension is reversed. And in this case, the Fermi anomalous dimension is in principle a physical quantity that you can measure. Okay. So these calculations raise a basic question of how can you control the expansion better. And one approach goes back to the work of Halpern, Lee, and Reed, and also Nayak and Wilczek on the half-filled Landau level. So the idea here is to replace the boson kinetic term by a non-local term. And this, provided that this epsilon is smaller than 1, makes the boson fluctuations less singular. Now physically, in the context of Landau level, such a term is not completely crazy. You can think of it as a long-range interaction between your original electrons, density-density interaction. Remember that in the half-filled Landau level, the density of electrons is precisely the magnetic flux of the emergent gauge field. So then if you use this relation and Fourier transform, then you get back to precisely this formula. In particular, the case epsilon equal to 0 corresponds to Coulomb interaction. So that's actually a problem that we might be very interested in, half-filled Landau level with Coulomb interaction. The case epsilon equal to 1, on the other hand, corresponds to a contact interaction that we have been studying earlier. Now, as I said, for epsilon small, gauge fluctuations are less singular. And you can see this in the RG in the following way. So now I'm going to do scaling slightly differently. Remember, before I did scaling in a somewhat unusual way by trying to keep the coupling constant between the gauge field and the fermion fixed. Here I'll do the more conventional scaling where I keep the fermion kinetic term fixed. This gives me the scaling of energy and momentum. And under such scaling, I find that the gauge fermion interaction is irrelevant if epsilon is less than 0, relevant if epsilon is larger than 0, and marginal at tree level if epsilon is equal to 0. So this half-filled Landau level with Coulomb interactions is really a marginal case. I can summarize these findings by introducing a dimensionless coupling constant alpha and at tree level alpha runs in this simple way. Now I can do quantum corrections, and in particular for epsilon equal to 0 I find again fermion self energy that now has a weaker singularity, has a omega log omega singularity. This is what people often call the marginal Fermi liquid. And if I give a RG interpretation of this singularity, I get the following flow of my coupling constant. So if I trust these one-loop calculations and interpret them in a RG way, then I come to the following conclusions. So if epsilon is equal to 0, then alpha flows logarithmically to 0. And this marginal Fermi liquid form obtained at one-loop order is asymptotically exact. If epsilon is larger than 0, then the alpha equals 0 fixed point is unstable, and alpha flows to a new interacting fixed point at this value, where the fermion self-energy has a true non-Fermi liquid-like behavior. So by the way, all of this analysis was given by Nayak and Wilczek a long time ago in the quantum Hall context. So this is all at one loop, And one can ask whether one can systematically proceed beyond one loop. And here, two approaches have been suggested. So first approach is to send epsilon to zero while keeping the number of fermion flavors fixed. So in this case, the one loop fixed point occurs at a small value of alpha proportional to epsilon, and you might hope that there is some kind of perturbative expansion. However, there is a potential difficulty again, because this is not, strictly speaking, true perturbation theory. You have to work with a gauge propagator, which is Landau-damped, which is dressed in order to avoid infrared divergences. But in the process of dressing, you see that you don't have the coupling constant only appearing in front, you also have it appearing here. And potentially, you can run into similar divergences that we ran into with our one over n expansion before, where we dressed the fermion self-energy. So this, the counting of powers of alpha in this case hasn't been systematically investigated, and I think it's a good problem to be done. There is an alternative expansion that has been suggested recently, and this is a kind of a double scaling limit, where you send epsilon to zero, n to infinity, while keeping n epsilon fixed. And this gives you a one loop fixed point value of the coupling constant, which is of order 1. So it's, the fixed point is now a strong coupling, but you can do a 1 over n expansion. So then you just do a straightforward 1 over n expansion, adjusting alpha at each order to be at the correct value of the fixed point. And this potentially is a this seems like a solid expansion to me. Of course, it cannot be applied to the case of epsilon precisely zero, because then alpha is zero and we are back, alpha star is zero and we are back to this problem. By the way, this also explains why we run into a problem with a large n expansion in the opposite limit, where we keep epsilon fixed and let n go to infinity. Because this is what we tried to do before. We kept epsilon fixed at 1 and let n go to infinity. Then the value of the fixed point coupling scales with n. So there are additional powers of n coming from the value of the fixed point coupling. Okay, now, independent of your of the calculational tool that you use, there are some scaling forms that you can write down in a very similar way to what we did before for the theory with epsilon equal to 1. So that they look exactly the same, actually. The only difference here is that the dynamical critical exponent cannot renormalize in this theory. It is fixed to be 2 plus epsilon. And the reason for that is that you're working with a non-local interaction, and the non-local interaction cannot be renormalized. This gauge piece in the action is non-local, and it cannot be renormalized. It's very similar to what Gordon Semenov has mentioned in his talk yesterday. However, the fermion anomalous dimension in this theory can be renormalized, and actually the MIT group has done calculation at three loop order, or at order 1 over n squared, and found a non-zero answer. So this at least confirms that our finding of an anomalous eta f when epsilon is equal to 1 was not a consequence of us neglecting some additional graphs, because our calculations are uncontrolled. This calculation is controlled, and you still find a non-zero ETA. So there is a question of whether one may perhaps try to access the point epsilon equal to 1 by doing a systematic expansion in epsilon. And if for epsilon equal 1, z actually renormalizes away from 3, then there is no hope of doing this. But if, for some magic reason again, z is protected to stay at 3, one may actually hope to systematically reach the value epsilon equal to 1 by doing an epsilon expansion. Okay, so this was a rather technical story, but at least I hope I convince you that we have at least a toy model where one may hope to extract some of this non-Fermi liquid critical Fermi surface physics systematically. Now let me change gears and talk about pairing instabilities of critical Fermi surface states. This is a somewhat more physical subject, I think. We'll see here that the two-patch theory that seemed to work, at least for this class of problems, in terms of describing the non-Fermi liquid singularities, actually definitely fails here. And we have to go beyond the two patches. OK, but let me start with this physical problem. So we know that an ordinary Fermi liquid is unstable to arbitrarily weak attraction in the BCS channel. So what is the corresponding statement for a critical Fermi surface? And here, we expect some difference between the case of a phase transition in a metal and the case of an emergent gauge field. For a phase transition in a metal, there is typically some spin channel or angular momentum channel, or often actually infinitely many angular momentum channels, where the order parameter fluctuations mediate attraction. So for example, if I look at the pneumatic transition, then definitely I have attraction in all spin channels and all angular momentum channels. Now, there is a fundamental problem that as I'm approaching the critical point, this pairing glue mediated by the order parameter fluctuations is becoming stronger and stronger. But at the same time, the same order parameter fluctuations destroy my quasi-particles that I'm trying to pair. So the question is, which effect wins? In particular, is the quantum critical point always unstable to superconductivity, as experiments seem to suggest? Now, in the case of a Fermi surface interacting with the gauge field, the situation is different. Because the long part of the gauge, the long range part of the gauge fluctuations actually mediates a repulsion in the BCS channel. Indeed, as you remember, it is the magnetic fluctuations, magnetic field fluctuations, that remain gapless in the presence of the Fermi surface. But magnetic field fluctuations mediate a current-current interaction. Now, the currents on the opposite sides of the Fermi surface are opposite. So we know that opposite currents repel. So we have this long-range repulsion, which means that it's a repulsion in all angular momentum channels. And the question is whether if we add to the problem now some short range for Fermi pairing interaction, which we expect to always be there microscopically, can that short range pairing interaction compete with the long range repulsion mediated by the gauge fluctuations? And if so, what is the critical strength of this short range repulsion? Of this short-range attraction. So if there is indeed a critical value of the attraction, beyond which the Fermi surface pairs, I can perhaps write down the following phase diagram. So here, as long as this interaction is not too attractive, I have a stable Fermi surface, in this case of spinons, with gapless spinons and gapless gauge or magnetic field fluctuations. Then, once I make V sufficiently attractive, my spinons pair in the same way as electrons pair in a superconductor, so they become gapped fermions. And in addition, so in the process of this pairing, I of course spontaneously break the U1 gauge symmetry. This is in some sense a Higgs phase now. So in the Z2 subgroup of this symmetry remains. That's why such phases are called Z2 spin liquids. And in particular, gauge fluctuations become gapped, and magnetic flux is now confined into vortices. And in the condensed matter community, such vortices are often referred to as Voisins. There is a corresponding story that one can imagine in the Hough-Landau level, where here, for sufficiently weak attraction, we start with a composite fermion liquid with gapless composite fermions and gapless magnetic field fluctuations, which you remember are the same as density fluctuations. So this is a compressible state. And then once the composite fermions pair, I can get one of the there are many paired states that have been suggested here from a microscopic point of view. A very popular one is a so-called Mourid state, where this composite fermions pair in the P plus IP channel. So as a result, again, I get these gapped fermions, and also I get gapped vortices confining my magnetic field. But you remember that magnetic flux density in this case is the same as the particle density. So it turns out that these vortices carry charge E over 4. So these are the famous quasi-particles in the Hough-Landau level, which have the Majorana statistics that people talk so much about. Now, there is evidence from exact diagonalization that such a transition can actually happen. And in exact diagonalization, it looks either as a second order transition or a crossover. These are only systems of 20 particles, so one cannot say for sure. But it doesn't look first order, at least. And previous theoretical work on the problem had concluded that actually such a transition is always first order due to gauge fluctuations. So here I will dispute this claim, and I will present RG calculations that indicate that the transition can be second order. So let me try to think about the problem of pairing in the presence of this critical Fermi surface. And as a starting point, let me compute the scattering amplitude in the BCS channel. And for a moment, let me work around this point epsilon equal to 0. So it turns out that this diagram is enhanced by the following factor compared to the three-level interaction. And you see that the way we have been doing scaling before, this two-patch scaling, where we scale both the momentum or the angle of the scattering and the frequency, this logarithm is actually completely harmless. However, if we do scaling the way we do in ordinary fermilipid theory, where we fix the scattering angle of these fermions, which is the same in this case as the momentum Q, and let the energy go to zero, then this logarithm is dangerous. And so there is a kind of conflict between the two ways of doing scaling, and this conflict, I believe, is not unrelated to the fact that if I just write down a Fermi, local Fermi interaction, then in the two-patch theory, under the two-patch scaling, such an interaction would be irrelevant. That's why up till now I have completely ignored it. But in a Fermi liquid, it would be marginal, at least at tree level. So how do we reconcile this? And there are actually worse problems coming our way. So if I now write down this local Fermi interaction, and I think about its renormalization in the two-patch theory, just computing the one-loop graph here, I obtain this very strong log-squared divergence. So it's a non-local divergence at one-loop order. That typically tells you that there is something wrong with your RG. It typically tells you that you are trying to integrate out some gapless excitations. And it's clear what you're doing wrong here. And you're starting with these two patches, and you're shrinking the cutoff by integrating out the electrons in the shaded area. But some of those fermions are exactly on the Fermi surface. So that's where this log squared is coming from. Like one of these logs is a usual BCS log. The other one is the critical log due to the gauge fluctuation. And the BCS log comes from the whole Fermi surface, and that way is dangerous. So as I already said, correct treatment of pairing instabilities requires us to somehow marry this two-patch scaling, where we really focus on the small angle scattering singularities, and the ordinary Fermi liquid scaling, where we focus on the whole Fermi surface. And there is a way of performing this marriage that has been suggested by Damson in the context of QCD at finite density. So the idea here is that in each RG step, we are going to start with our patches covering the Fermi surface, and we are going to further subdivide them into smaller patches. And now we are going to keep the interpatch couplings. And what kind of couplings should we keep? Well, it's clear. We know that there are only two types of scattering processes for fermion interactions, which keep all the fermions in the vicinity of the Fermi surface: forward scattering interactions and BCS scattering interactions. Now, let me ignore forward scattering for a moment. Mainly I ignore it because I don't fully understand it. Let me focus on these BCS interactions, and those are anyway relevant for the pairing problem. So now we know that this, in ordinary Fermi-liquid theory, the BCS interactions flow in the following way. This comes from the usual one-loop graph. However, now there is an additional element, because we are starting with our patches, and we are subdividing them into further patches in the RG process. And here, at each step, we are integrating gauge fluctuations, or bosonic fluctuations, with momentum in this range. So what previously was an intra-patch interaction, kind of non-local interaction mediated by this boson, now becomes a local interpatch interaction that I can lump into my BCS coupling V. And if I think about it, If I go now to different angular momentum channels, I see that in all angular momentum channels, it generates the following flow of V. Where remember, alpha was my coupling constant associated with this boson exchange. So now let me combine this piece generated in this way together with the ordinary Fermi liquid piece in the RG. And let me further combine this with the flow of the coupling constant alpha that I previously obtained in the two-patch theory. And now I'm just going to take these RG equations and solve them. So there are two cases. There is this case of phase transition in the metal and the gauge case. But let me start first with the transition in the metal. So here, boson fluctuations mediate attraction in the BCS channel. So they drive B negative, and that drive is reinforced by ordinary Fermi liquid RG, which also tends to decrease V. So these two effects now come together, and as a result, these equations always flow to the point V equal to minus infinity, which we interpret as tendency to pairing. So we conclude that the quantum critical point in the metal is always unstable to pairing. Moreover, wherever we can do calculations in a controlled manner, that is, whenever epsilon is much smaller than 1, this pairing scale is much larger than the non-Fermi liquid scale. That is, pairing preempts the non-Fermi liquid physics. So instead of this picture with a strange metal coming out from inside a superconducting dome, we get a picture where the strange metal is completely hidden by the superconducting dome and is inaccessible as a function of temperature. So that's, in some sense, not very satisfactory. But at least we get the superconducting dome. So one can be a bit more detailed. So one can solve these equations for epsilon equal to 0. So and in that case, one finds a pairing scale which depends in the following way on alpha as constant over square root of alpha, whereas the non-Fermi liquid scale goes as exponential of 1 over alpha. So you see that this is always a much larger scale. And this is essentially exactly the result that has been found in dense quark matter, where again, pairing instability mediated by the color gauge field always masks any non-Fermi liquid physics. Now, when epsilon is larger than 0, the physics, the solution of these flow equations now will depend on alpha over epsilon squared and ratio of V over alpha. But at least in the alpha to 0 limit, you find that the pairing scale is enhanced compared to the non-Fermi liquid scale in the following way. You see, 1 over epsilon to the power of 2 over epsilon. So that's a very large number. And I've been told that actually this result has been obtained much earlier using Elgar calculations by Emil Yuzbashyan. I'll mention in a second Elgar calculations, and we'll see that they actually completely reproduce this picture, at least for epsilon much smaller than 1. Now, let's come to pairing pairing in the presence of this gauge field, of the U1 gauge field. As I already said, U1 gauge field mediates a long-range repulsive interaction in all angular momentum channels. So there is a plus sign here. it tends to drive in the RG, it tends to drive the BCS amplitude positive. And this effect competes with the ordinary Fermi-liquid RG, which tends to drive the BCS amplitude to smaller values. So then we really have to solve this equation together with the flow equation of the coupling constant alpha. In particular, let's for now focus on this case epsilon equal to zero. This is the half-filled Landau level with Coulomb interactions. And this is my favorite plot in the whole story. So this is the flow of these equations. So you see that if V is sufficiently large, that is, if V is to the right of this red line, then the flow is towards a single fixed point here at V equals 0, alpha equal to 0. This is the, I interpret this as the stable, or, well, I interpret this as the marginal Fermi-liquid, composite Fermi-liquid fixed point. However, once I cross this red line, that is, once the attraction becomes sufficiently strong, the flow runs away to minus infinity. And I interpret this as pairing, and one can calculate how the pairing gap depends on the deviation from this critical point, from this line. And it behaves in this rather unusual super power law manner, e to the minus log squared. I haven't really actually seen that anywhere else. Now, if you turn on epsilon larger than zero, then the situation is somewhat more standard. So here, the coupling constant alpha flows to this fixed point value. This is our non-Fermi-liquid fixed point. And the flow of V now has two fixed points. One occurs at a positive value of V and is a stable fixed point. So I interpret this as the critical Fermi surface fixed point. And then there is a fixed point, there is an unstable fixed point at a negative value of V. And this is interpreted as the pairing transition. And I can calculate how the gap onsets if I cross this, if I'm to the left of this fixed point. And now it onsets with a much more typical power law, in a much more typical power law fashion. So this this RG analysis suggests that, first of all, the critical Fermi surface state is stable against pairing for sufficiently weak values of the pairing interaction. And once the pairing interaction becomes sufficiently strong, a second order phase transition into a paired phase is possible.
So Max, is something like that seen? I mean, where you have a critical phase that doesn't become superconducting?
So remember, this is for this unusual liquids where a gauge field emerges. This is not for a metal. So as I said, there is some numerics in the quantum Hall context where this is suspected. Now, there is a separate question of whether there are critical points in metals that don't go superconducting. And I guess in principle that there are some. It's not always, I believe, that one finds a superconducting dome. But this is not superconductivity in the true sense. This is pairing, right?
Yes.
So it's not.
What do you mean is that a spin on Fermi surface is stable?
Well, it's not even clear that there are materials which do have spin on Fermi surface. The candidates that we have, in fact, you have written a paper claiming that they might be actually paired.
But
At least it seems like material-wise, there are two different classes of materials, for which one class is where they seem to be bearing some kind, there is certainly superlunar theory, phase diagram, actual superlunar theory. So one can think of that coming out of the spinel body surface. And other one doesn't have. So I was saying that somehow, given that you're finding both of these examples, it seems like it's consistent.
No, I agree. I think.
There's no proof yet that those materials
are. The comment here is the following. There are some the candidates for this spin liquid states with a Fermi surface. Some of them under pressure go metallic with no superconductivity, and some go superconducting under pressure. So this is an insulator. These spin liquids are always insulators. My phase diagram might not be completely faithful. So I believe this material DMIT that I mentioned has this kind of phase diagram, and the other material that's discussed, kappa ET, has this kind of diagram. So what has been suggested is that perhaps, you know, this insulating phase here, this insulator, this unusual insulator with no order, perhaps it's a spin on Fermi surface state with a Fermi surface derived from this metallic state, and this insulator, in this case, is a paired spin-on Fermi surface with a pairing kind of derived from this superconducting phase here. So in that sense, it is possible. It has been suggested that there can be indeed two different states of matter.
I get it right. It's just because you have these long range. The pulses coming from the Gauss boson, it's not a natural that you can have a critical point for the metal to the subconic, right? It's not very deep in a way.
Yeah. The long-range repulsion prevents the pairing. The pairing instability drives the pairing instability to a finite value, to a finite negative value of V.
Yeah.
Unlike in a Fermi liquid, where this instability occurs at V equals zero. Okay, so instead of doing RG, one can also do an uncontrolled calculation, which is known as an Elle-Arbeck calculation. So here one sums up all this.
Start back to the equipment. Right at that critical point, is some other interesting metallic state.
This state.
Yeah.
I'll get back to that question. So let me get back. Right. So if I do Elle-Arbeck, so Elle-Arbeck is summing up all this ladder type or rainbow type graphs in the BCS channel using the Drest fermion and Drest boson propagators. This is what people typically do for the electron phonon interactions in metals when the electron phonon interaction is large. And So doing these Elle-Arbeck calculations exactly reproduces the qualitative features of the RG that I've discussed so far, and it also reproduces the RG results quantitatively as long as epsilon is much smaller than 1. Of course, one can do these uncontrolled calculations for any value of epsilon, and one can, for example, extract the correlation length exponent.
It's controlled by any top parameter, right?
Pardon?
It is controlled by a Migdal parameter.
Yes, omega the pi over the Fermi energy. So
in this context, isn't it so that you have also kind of a Migdal parameter, that the fluctuations driving the pairing are actually strongly retarded compared to EF?
So I think in this case, the Migdal parameter is this epsilon, or 1 over n. That's when you can neglect. There is no Migdal parameter in the sense of omega debye, in the same sense of omega debye over EF, I think.
But they're basically massless case bosons, right? And they are like acoustic phonons.
They are like acoustic phonons, rather than optical. So the Migdal case, most of the pairing is done by optical, by phonons.
Yeah, but you can include acoustic phonons as
the acoustic phonons also. There is a kind of,
pairing comes from acoustic phonons.
Oh, really?
And Jasperk is a great theory out there, except that aluminum is so weakly coupled that you can just get the various PCRs. Right? And so my kids think that you have to worry about retardation as well in these problems.
No, no, this is very, you know, retardation is built in from the very beginning because you are putting in this Landau damping. Right? Or in the RG, it might not. It's not put in explicitly, but it's put in implicitly by using a particular value of the dynamical exponent.
I think it cannot be quite coincidental. So could it be that somehow the control by Migdal that's inside the Ellsberg is actually wired in the normalization effectively, and that you do the same neglect of first corrections?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's not surprising that there is this exact agreement because what we have put into the RG is precisely this same diagrams.
Yeah.
We put in the same, you know, we put in the fact that the Fermi velocity runs, and that's the renormalization. You know, that's the Drest fermion. Propagator, we put in the fact that the dynamical critical exponent is given by essentially it's close. Well, that's the same running of the Fermi velocity gives you the dynamical critical exponent, which is essentially related to the fact that the gauge propagator is retarded. And we put the only non-trivial element, the one additional non-trivial element that we put in is this element. Mm-hmm. where at each step in the RG the long range interaction becomes a short range interaction, and that's, you know, essentially putting in this infinite set of lines. So, in a sense, you get what you put in, but it's still nice. Okay, so there are some open questions here. First one is whether we can make this RG procedure more systematic. As we just discussed, I just put in some I've just gone to leading order in a sense in alpha or epsilon, and I just only put in this limited number of diagrams. But can one really make this RG as a systematic expansion in epsilon? You know, for example, calculate this critical exponent for the onset of the paired state systematically as a power of epsilon. And I don't know yet how to do this. I think it will be very helpful to explore analogies with particle physics, in particular in particle physics there are similar issues. One can think about a low energy, low momentum limit, kind of infrared limit, but one can also think about scaling towards the light cone, and there are separate singularities that occur on the light cone, and people have discussed actually how to disentangle these singularities. It goes under the name of soft collinear effective field theory, And I think we are facing very similar issues here on the technical level. This marriage of two-patch scaling and the Fermi-liquid scaling, and I believe there is a lot to be learned from here. Now, let me get back to perhaps more physical question that Chetan raised, which is whether the properties of the critical Fermi surface are different at these two critical points. In the treatment that I've just discussed, they're not. There is no feedback of the pairing fluctuations on the Fermi surface, on the properties of the fermions, and also on the properties of the gauge field. And that seems to be reasonable at leading order, at least. Now, whether it's true to all orders is another question. And I believe that it might even be true at all orders, because you know that in an ordinary Fermi liquid, the BCS interaction never fits back onto the fermion propagator.
It's controlled by the interfering coherence length. When you look at the pairing strength, you get in sort of a local pair regime. That's where the metal state above the supporting transition is anything but the simple fermion liquid. It's a matter you put it in by hand. You assume that you're in a deep BCS recovery limit.
So let me be on the positive side of. I agree with the fact that it's all.
It's such a by hand, right?
Yes, but it is a weak coupling limit, and yeah. I'm only trying to do
your
calculations here in the weak coupling limit in the sense that epsilon is small.
Yeah, that is very simple because the way that the pair fluctuations feed back into the liquid is set by the coherence length, and it's very, very large. It's your scale, that's very mean field.
I agree. Let me put it another way. Let me put it another way. I don't even have to be on the paired side of the transition. Let me be in a Fermi liquid with V positive, and let me think about the effect of this interaction. You know, they are marginally irrelevant, but they decay very slowly as 1 over log, so I can still definitely think about their effect on the fermion self-energy. And definitely I know that the only effect comes from these kinds of graphs. I can also address this in principle. But anyway, you know, these effects are irrelevant. They go as omega squared, perhaps with some additional logarithms. But so in this sense, both the pairing and the forward scattering interactions do not feed back on the electron propagator. So it is possible that the similar situation happens here. And it is possible that the interpatch couplings never feed back on the two-patch theory. Certainly, you would hope that here they wouldn't feed back because that was the assumption of my earlier story. And perhaps by the same token, they don't feed back here. Okay, another interesting question is properties of this paired state here, close to the phase transition. So we can think of this paired state as some kind of a superconductor, right? And we know that superconductor can be type 1 or type 2. In a type 1 superconductor, vortices like to clump. So you have essentially Meissner effect, complete expansion of flux up to some critical magnetic field. In a type 2 superconductor, on the other hand, vortices repel, and above some critical magnetic field, the magnetic field starts to penetrate into the superconductor in the form of this abrikosov lattice. So here we can ask about a similar question, which is particularly pressing in the case of a quantum hole of a quantum hole system. Now, if I change my magnetic field, my external magnetic field a little bit, or if I go slightly away from half filling in this paired state, do I immediately get phase separation, or do I get this kind of vortex of this E over 4 quasi-particles? Or do I get a vortex lattice of this E over 4 quasi-particles? And so that depends on essentially the type of this superconductor. And it's very reasonable to believe that this superconductor close to the transition will actually be type 1.
Because what is the Landau, so what is the London penetration depth analogy?
So I believe that the London penetration depth here will go to some constant as you approach the transition, which is what happens actually in an ordinary Fermi-liquid. You know, you can even think about a Galilean invariant Fermi-liquid where you know that the superfluid density is basically just n squared over m is given by the full density. And I believe that something very similar will happen here, that the London penetration depth will stay constant as you approach so for a type 1 superconductor, London penetration depth is defined in a slightly different way. You know, there is this non-local p-part regime, and there will be also that here. But morally, I believe you'll have a type 1 superconductor here, which has important implications for the phenomenology of this state, especially in the quantum Hall context. Another interesting question is actually, how does the vortex mass vanish as you approach the transition? In principle, you know, this is really a problem with many different scales. You know, the dynamical exponents for the bosons and fermions are not the same. It doesn't have to vanish in the same way as the fermion gap. So this is still an open and, I believe, interesting question. By the way, I don't actually know how the vortex mass vanishes in an ordinary type 1 superconductor as one approaches this transition, as one approaches the point V equals 0.
Questions never ask, are you, because they don't occur in type 1 superconductors.
Well, there are some type 1. Well, okay, so
that is type 1 because you don't have a because of phase.
Sure, it's experimentally one. Yeah. It's perhaps difficult
to
access.
That's what I'm referring to, yeah. You can ask the question on your piece, just one flux loop.
But theoretically, you know, so it's, you know, it's possible you can have a single vortex in a type 1 superconductor. It might drift to the edge of the sample or something, but in principle you could try to pin it. So I described some recent progress and perhaps even more recent challenges in understanding critical Fermi surface states in 2+1 dimensions. Describe the first theory of pairing transition out of a critical Fermi surface state, I believe I convinced you that there are still lots of open and interesting questions. Thank you.
Underneath a superconductor, there are many samples. I think my transition is buried actually inside the superconductor domain. So did you actually try to use this mechanism to address some of the underneath a superconductor problem? Or?
So the question is, do I understand the question correctly that...
Yeah, but first of all, you draw here. I just first assume some of the underneath a superconductor under either pressure or doping.
So the question is, this whole theory is essentially assuming that you have an underlying metallic state.
Yeah, sure.
And once you flow, so to describe the transition in a superconductor is of course in a completely different universality class than the transition, and people know actually how to describe it, I guess, at least in a D-wave superconductor, there has been a lot of work.
Well, I think Pupil is S by O S plus minus wave, so I think it's
Sure. So you know, if it's a completely, at least if it's a completely gapped Fermi surface, then the pneumatic transition inside the superconductor is trivial in a sense, it's just a Z2 Ising transition. But I think your question is about how does this transition connect to the properties of the Fermi liquid? If I raise the temperature, you know, is there some backbending of the phase transition line? Yeah, I think it perhaps may be possible to address some questions like that here.
Is it understood how this supermolecular density occurs in the Dirac case when you have a fermion coupled to a dual gauge field as like a leverage term?
So I guess there it's also, you know, it's a four Fermi interaction there, which is irrelevant from the outset. So you have to somehow go to large coupling, or I guess you can try to do some order parameter for the superconductor coupled to the fermions and to the gauge field. I don't know if people have analyzed that field theory. But I assume that perhaps one can formulate some kind of a one over n limit in that case. It's perhaps not as interesting.
Any more questions?
Right, no, let's thank Max for coming back.